You're listening to the Corner House podcast. Available to download every month from the Corner House website.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Corner House podcast. I'm Dave Petty, AV technician here at Corner House, and I'll be your host for this month. To mark the May release of Wes Anderson's Moonrise Kingdom, we'll be doing things a bit differently on the podcast this month, so stay tuned for an in-depth discussion on the films and credentials of this much-hyped director. We'll also be hearing from Subversion artist Khaled Hafez, who'll talk about his video piece on presidents and superheroes. Plus, we'll be giving you our pick of some great things to do in May in our What's On guide. Wes Anderson's seventh feature, Moonrise Kingdom, opens in cinemas later this month. Set in the 1960s, the film tells the story of a pair of young lovers and scouting enthusiasts who flee their New England town, prompting a local search party led by the sheriff and the girl's parents. As is typical of Wes Anderson's films, the film features a stellar cast including Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, Tilda Swinton, Harvey Keitel and Frances McDormand, plus regulars Bill Murray and Jason Schwartzman.
Where's your sister?
I don't know, but she bought my record player for 10 days without asking.
What does that mean?
Dear Lionel, I need to use your record player. I will give it back in 10 days or less. Do not tell Mom or Dad. I will replace the batteries when I return. Signed, Susie Bishop.
Walt, where the hell are you?
Right here. Does it concern you that your daughter has just run away from home?
That's a loaded question.
The film's premiering at Cannes, so sadly we've not been privy to a preview copy, but in anticipation of its release, we've gathered Abandoned Normal Devices festival coordinator Aphrodite Barnperusi and podcast regular Andy Willis to recap Anderson's previous work and to discuss what we can expect from his latest film. So, on that note, I'd like to start with a quote from Scorsese, who said about Bottle Rocket, which was Anderson's first film, as you probably both no doubt aware, that it was without a trace of cynicism that obviously grew out of its director's affection for his characters in particular and for people in general. That Anderson knows how to convey the simple joys and interactions between people so well and with such richness. This kind of sensibility is rare in movies. And he then goes on to say that he really liked Rushmore, and I personally think what he says goes for all of Anderson's films. But enough from me, what do you guys think?
Well, I think that's quite a good description of Bottle Rocket. One of the things I would say is, though, as someone's career develops and as they make a number of films, one might be expecting different responses. So it's quite interesting in a way, and I think something that's maybe something we can pick up on is this fact that perhaps Wes Anderson's films, rather than developing across his career, are kind of in a perpetual circle, almost like his films become like a situation comedy. You know, everything seems to go back to the beginning for the next one and we go through the same process again. Maybe, you know, just different settings, different characters, but broadly speaking, the same sort of shtick from time after time after time.
I'm getting the feeling that you say that as if it's a bad thing, or am I right or am I wrong?
For me, that's not necessarily a good thing. Not necessarily a bad thing, because audiences know what they like. If they like his films, then they know they're going to deliver. So there's a positive side to it. But in terms of talking about someone's career as a filmmaker, I would like to see, personally, you know, more sense of development. Go to a Wes Anderson film and go, good heavens, I didn't expect that. Whereas opposed to what I think does happen is you go, oh, good heavens, I did expect that.
Hmm. I'll have to agree with Andy, I suppose, in the sense that they do have a kind of sense of sameness going over and over again. However, to agree with Dave on the other side, I don't think as a filmmaker he can change the world in that sense. He doesn't seem to be a groundbreaking, making a shift, you know, in the cinema, in the way you view the world, in the way you view society and all these kind of issues. So for me, it's all about him making an enjoyable experience. Expect to see something that is absolutely grand in the sense of incorporating beautiful music, beautiful scenery, beautiful filmmaking, photography. So for me, it's not necessarily a bad thing that he has a style of filmmaking and he kind of recycles that over and over, making some adjustments and making some alterations. And actually, I have a sense that he's progressing in his films in some way, but I don't think that he's a filmmaker that can be judged on the themes of his films. It's more about how he portrays the different characters, and I think that's kind of like a truthful representation of what he wants to portray.
I mean, I actually noted down that since Bottle Rocket, he's developed, but It's more like it's like a refinement of what he's good at. I don't think that's no bad thing. I mean, definitely all his films, they feel the same. I mean, a lot of that's down to the cinematographer who he uses, Robert Yeoman, who he's used on all his live-action films, Fantastic Mr. Fox aside. So that, you know, the fisheye lens and everything being symmetrical, all the kind of theatrical performances. If you don't like that, then you're not going to like his films. People have said he's a bit of a Marmite director, and I think that's, you know, largely true. But if you do like his films, then I think there's absolutely loads to enjoy. I mean, I watched The Life Aquatic again last night, and I think it's actually only the second time I've watched it since I've seen it at the cinema. And the amount of detail in there, I mean, it's almost overwhelming. And I think his films for repeat viewings are absolutely perfect.
I think that's an interesting point, Dave, because one of the things that I find frustrating is that attention to detail, which to me doesn't really deliver anything. So it's got an incredibly almost overthought through mise-en-scene. It seems to be just all about the mise-en-scene. It doesn't seem to be serving anything. Now, I think it's interesting that you quoted Scorsese, because I think Scorsese is a director at his peak in the 1970s and early 80s when, again, an incredibly precise mise-en-scene, but it's always at the service of what the film's about. Here, it just seems to be at the service of the general quirkiness of everything. So the mise-en-scene is to enhance the quirkiness, and I think that often comes up in discussions about Wes Anderson is he a smart arse and not a lot more? And I think this over-elaborate mise-en-scene and cinematography maybe contributes towards people thinking that. So it seems very smart, but I'm not sure the smartness really adds up to much.
I don't know. I'd like to disagree, because his films are beautiful to look at, but again, watching Life Aquatic last night, which was largely panned on release. I mean, it was a $50 million film, which for, you know, a supposed kind of quirky indie is a ludicrous budget. It did make a loss. It made about a $50 million loss. But the amount of detail he puts, not just into the look of the film, but into the characters. And I think one of the things that's been thrown at Wes Anderson is that he puts everything into the pot. There's always a dozen or so characters that you have to kind of focus on. But the fact that you pick them out and you remember them, they're not throwaway. You know, these are characters who are kind of rounded. Some of them may be a little bit one-dimensional, but, you know, as far as the story goes, I think you can invest in these characters, at least for me anyway. It might not be the same for yourself, Andy, but I get a lot out of his films in terms of what's going on, not just the visuals.
I would agree, and I'd say that we shouldn't really fall into the trap of grouping all his films together. I think the thing that does happen in discussion around Wes Anderson is that people tend to think of them as one thing rather than examining each film in its own merits. Whether he's a smartass or a cutie pie, I think it can be both. And I think that in today's cinema world, this serves its purpose and it has an audience that he sticks with and they're loyal. I would say also that they're humorous, kind of satirical element to them, but not in this British sense of humour. Is in a very, very American settings, uses American characters, American styles of dressing, you know, references to cars, reference to transport systems.
I would say there's a lot of European influences as well. But even so, I mean, what you said about him being a smartass, I think it's sort of unfair, because that portrays him to be very aloof. I personally wouldn't consider him aloof, again, going back to the investment that he puts into his characters, and especially characters who should be unlikable. I mean, Gene Hackman in The Royal Tenenbaums is a horrendous character. He's not very nice at all, but you can't help but like him.
I want my family back.
Well, you can't have it. I'm sorry for you, but it's too late.
Baby, I'm dying. I'll be dead in 6 weeks.
What are you talking about? What's the prognosis?
Take it easy, Ethel. Hold on, baby. Hold on. Wait a second. Okay, listen. I'm not dying, but I need some time. A month or so, okay?
What's wrong with you?
Now, the way you're looking at me, Andy, it would suggest that you disagree with me on that entirely.
Once again, Dave, and Aphrodite, I seem to be out on a limb here. One of the things that strikes me is that when I watch them, I actually have a lot of problem sympathising with many of the characters, because I find them all a bit too clever, and a bit too constructed as characters. I think you can almost see the construction of the character, so they don't come alive for me as kind of real characters on screen, or I'm loath to say it, but, you know, real believable people on screen, because they're not really inhabiting that kind of world, so I'm not sure that's the right way to judge them. But really, I don't have an empathy for the characters. Often when they're in scrapes or they're in awkward situations, I'm just thinking, bloody, you deserve it. Get on with it. Sort yourself out. So, I mean, again, one of the interesting things, I think, if we compare someone like Wes Anderson and the way that his films work to, say, someone like Robert Altman in the 70s, again, with multiple characters, and again, with a very quirky sense of humour and very offbeat characterisations, his films always seemed very grounded in the actual society of the time, and the way the stories worked and the way the characters were offbeat seemed very much anchored in that historical moment. One of the things I think I have problems with Wes Anderson is with regard to the fact that they seem almost timeless, and I don't think that's a good thing. I like the characters to be anchored in when the film's made and to be about that time rather than almost from no time. And that's, I think, adds to the quirkiness and adds to why people like them. But it kind of is something that frustrates me. I mean, I can see why people like the films, but I find them frustrating.
I would agree with your point about theatricality, and it feels like they're staged. And I think the music and slow motion sessions in the films, however you want to describe them, kind of add to that. But this is actually making them a bit more unique. They don't look flawless. They might be flowing well, and the characters performing well, and they're staged. But there are instances in the looks of characters, in their faces, where you're thinking, is that the right look? Or is he playing with our expectations? What exactly is happening here? There's kind of a lot of interpretations, and that alludes to the fact that these characters have so many different dimensions, let's say. They're almost too weird to be real. So I think that's something that adds to his films, the fact that you kind of distance yourself from the film. You can see it as a parody a little bit because it is a parody and it is a bit of a pastiche.
One thing I always think is, are these films inviting us as an audience to think we're as clever as the filmmaker? Or are they films that are just amusing and funny and we go along with them? Because I'm always uneasy about films that invite the audience to think they're clever.
How about if audiences think that they are cool?
I'm even more concerned then. But I think you're right. I think that's part of this as well.
I'd say that Wes Anderson gets that thrown at him a lot, that, you know, he's very much the cool hipster kind of filmmaker. I mean, if he was from Manchester, then he'd be hanging out in the Northern Quarter 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But I think he's a little bit more unique than that. He's a bit more of a one-off. There's plenty of other filmmakers who he has worked with and who he's influenced. I mean, there's people like Noah Baumbach, Jason Schwartzman, obviously a regular collaborator, Roman Coppola, who's done second unit work and written some of his stuff with him. And these are filmmakers who, you know, have similar kind of styles and similar aesthetics. They, you know, they all work in similar circles. But I said it earlier on, he doesn't strike me as aloof and cool. You know, he seems to me very much the outsider. I think a certain portion of his audience probably thinks that he's quite cool.
Well, Dave, you said he got $50 million to make A Life Aquatic. How much of an outsider is a $50 million budget filmmaker?
No comment.
His films, or him, he as a filmmaker and the kind of, you know, people he groups around him have that sense of not being part of the mainstream, but they get very big actors who then want to work in more offbeat films. And I think they present themselves as offbeat, but they're very much, always strike me as kind of, you know, Hollywood insiders who just are not making big action movies, but they seem to be in the system. They don't seem to be outside the system.
I think you're kind of right. I mean, Alec Baldwin was the narrator in Royal Tenenbaums. You know, he's not so big now, but I mean, he's done, you know, a lot of other big stuff like 30 Rock on TV, you know, very much big in his day. And I mean, now with Moonrise Kingdom, you've got Bruce Willis and Ed Norton and Harvey Keitel. I mean, these are people who you just wouldn't expect to show up in a Wes Anderson film. But then at the same time, when they do, it just feels almost as if it was a perfect fit. So you're right, it does come across very much like, you know, the big actors wanting to work with the cool kid in town. But I don't think that's a bad thing, and that comes back to what you're saying about how you view his films. I take them as like little enjoyable stories. That might sound very throwaway. That might sound like it's devaluing the films, but I enjoy them for what they are. I don't try and garner some kind of higher meaning from them. I think if Wes Anderson's films are saying anything, it's a lot about dysfunctionality, really. I mean, ill-fitting friendships, doomed relationships and social ineptitude, people who really want to do good things but, you know, are failing miserably at them. And especially in terms of relationships, I mean, that goes for Rushmore with his infatuation with his teacher, Gene Hackman and his failed marriage, constantly trying to win his wife back, you know, by pretending he has cancer at one point. It's horrendous behaviour. But all these kind of themes, they all kind of add up to one big whole, I think. You know, taken as they are, just his films, they're lovely little stories, and I think they're perfectly crafted.
It seems as you guys are a bit more kind of championing him a bit more than I am. Like I say, not that I dislike the films particularly, I just find them a bit on a treadmill of the same stuff again and again.
I think they are, but that's, to me, and to Aphrodite, that's not a bad thing.
But when do you think everything comes together best? Which of his films would you say everything locks in and it works really, really well? Because I think some you can see slightly misfiring a bit. I think A Life Aquatic's got, you know, it's like he's got too much money to do what he wants to do, so he kind of overdoes everything. But when do you think it all meshes together best? Convince me, guys.
For me, it's Rushmore. Absolutely everything in it is so well-rounded. It is very funny without being too ridiculous. It is very quirky, but it's got a real heart to it. And I think that's probably where, you know, in some of his later films, he has misfired. I mean, Darjeeling Limited, for me, that's his weakest film. A lot of people quite like that after Life Aquatic, but for me, it didn't feel like it hit a lot of the right notes. I think Aphrodite would probably disagree with me on this. But again, that's, you know, that's the good thing about Wes Anderson. I mean, you get different things from each of his films, despite them all feeling very similar. You know, they can affect everyone in different ways.
Yeah, I disagree with Dave. For me, the two highlights, I'd struggle to distinguish between the two, would be Darjeeling Limited and The Royal Tenenbaums, as everybody would expect, the most talked about film. Darjeeling, because to me, it's set in a very unique location that you wouldn't expect a satire type film to be set in with those kind of actors. So you don't really see a lot of non-Bollywood or non-action films happening in that part of the world. And I think it's well portrayed in the sense that it's different, it's bizarre, it's a bit dangerous.
I want us to become brothers again like we used to be.
You're the two most important people in the world to me.
This is incredible!
Why haven't we spoken in a year?
Because we don't trust each other.
Is that my belt? Can I borrow it?
Royal Tenenbaums, because it might be just for pure preference in terms of colour and music, but it brings together everything that I like about that type of cinema. After watching Royal Tenenbaums, I could actually think of the actual actors and imagine them performing some of the scenes in their everyday life that you'd see during the film. Gwyneth Paltrow, I could see her having a haircut and going around in that blue lipstick and that nail varnish. Again, music for me is a big factor in his films, and every scene that is important is background by the perfect tune to accompany the feeling and the importance or the stupidity, if you want, of the situation.
The music of the films is something that Martin Scorsese referenced again. He was talking about Bottle Rocket, and then he went on to talk about the end scene of Rushmore, where the teacher takes off his glasses, is looking into his eyes, and the Faces song, I Wish I Knew Then What I Knew Now, comes on and the curtains close, and it's a beautiful moment. I mean, it's almost kind of spine tingling, which is not what you'd expect from his kind of films. In a more contemporary setting, the use of Sigur Rós towards the end of Life Aquatic, when you see the jaguar shark, when I first saw that, for some reason I started crying. Now, I've no idea why, because it's not an overly emotional scene until after the shark's kind of gone and you see Bill Murray crying and everyone put their hands on his shoulders. But just in terms of matching the music with the scenes, I think he can do it brilliantly. Not all the time, but a hell of a lot. His music really, really works. I mentioned earlier on about his influence on his contemporaries. One of the films that stuck out to me that seemingly took a lot from Wes Anderson was Richard Ayoade's Submarine. Now, I don't know whether either of you would agree or disagree with that.
Yeah, I can see some of the influence, although Submarine, I think, is wears its influences from the late 60s, early 70s French New Wave much more, which I think Anderson attempts to draw on, but hasn't got quite, I don't think, the deftness of touch for that.
But at the same time, do you not think Anderson is maybe a bit more unique, you know, in terms of taking influences and not necessarily wearing them on his sleeve, but, you know, reshaping them into something that's got his stamp on it, that isn't just rehashing things that have happened in cinema of the past?
No, I think being unique at the beginning is fine, but it's not unique anymore because it's the same stuff again and again in a different bottle.
But then you've got artists. I mean, I hate to make a bold comparison, but someone like Salvador Dali, who used, you know, the elephants with the massive long legs, they appear in all kinds of his paintings. I won't talk about the melting clocks because that's overstated. But people, to me, didn't get bored of what he was doing. He's held in high regard.
By some. Like I said earlier, I would compare it to Scorsese. And if you look at Scorsese's run in the 70s, you know, Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, Alice Doesn't Love Here Anymore, New York, New York, Raging Bull into the 80s, they're all incredibly different films, although obviously all made by the same person. And I don't intend, you know, to be getting into the kind of auteur stuff. But Wes Anderson strikes me as being on the handcart to Tim Burton hell of just doing the same stuff again and again and again, to the point where you think, I'm not sure I even need to see that film.
I know exactly what you mean, Tim Burton, especially nowadays. I'm very much bored of what he does. I mean, it is the same thing. Well, I say the same thing. I mean, he did stuff like Planet of the Apes, which I thought was dreadful. That's, you know, that didn't really feel like a Tim Burton film at all. It was him diversifying, and it didn't work. So he maybe was good at what he did at a certain point in his career, and maybe in a few years' time, I'll be sitting down watching a Wes Anderson film going, yeah, I've seen this, and I'm bored of it. But for me now, his films work. And they work for me. And they clearly work for Aphrodite as well.
Well, to me, it comes down to the ultimate question about every director. Should they give up after the best film? Should they continue doing what they know how to do best? Or should they carry on in trying to make it something better? And for me, the answer to this, my personal opinion, is unless you're convinced you can do something better, just stick with what you do well.
I think on that note, we could wrap this up. Moonrise Kingdom, although we've not spoke too much about it, I'm definitely looking forward to it. It screens at Corner House from Friday the 25th of May. Early booking is now open on our website and our box office.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast. Visit the Corner House website for listings and more.
Our current exhibition, Subversion, features video artist Khaled Hafez and one of his most iconic works on presidents and superheroes. The piece melds together found media footage with animated interventions by ancient Egyptian Anubis figures, set to an upbeat disco-themed soundtrack. Digital reporter Ben Monahan caught up with the artist to find out more.
I'm Khaled Hafez. I am a Cairo-based artist. And the artwork is called the A778 Project on Presidents and Superheroes. There is 2D and 3D animation. The idea of using a superhero, because the problem with our first republic, with the coup d'etat of 1952, that turned into a revolution somehow. There was always the president who is a superhero, you know, like the guy who would kickbox, dance, kiss, and, you know, like who should be able to do everything. The idea was to create a state that would somehow represent what's happening in the Egyptian street, actually. It's sort of like taking a pick from different elements of the Egyptian street today. This is the only work in which I used animation in. Since I touched the medium of film in 2001, irony is principally me. The idea was to create a state that would somehow represent what's happening in the Egyptian street, actually. You know, rising right-wing fundamentalism. This was 2 years before now we have Islamists in the parliament. And then the demonstrations, this was like 2 years before we did the revolution, you know, in 2011. Every single image was taken, photoshopped, shaved the background and inserted on the video or on a background that is, which is a taken footage or a taken imagery that I took. I took the speech of Nasser in the 60s, is resignation speech, and then took it to sound studio and spliced a bit certain words. But the initial motifs were extracted from media propagated imagery, internet images. So there is even one, the guy with a Vespa or a motorbike. This comes from Pakistan. The petrodollar Gulf fellow who's photographing his women, apparently it's a family visiting Paris. But I took all the backgrounds and we worked the Photoshop into a different background, took it out of a context and created another context. I started as a painter and I adopted, you know, every few years I would extend my own limits and touch another medium. To me, I don't mind at all the label of Arab art or African art or Mediterranean art, as long as they represent me, because I'm Egyptian and Egyptian identity is extremely complex.
Khaled Hafez's work is just one of many pieces included in our group show Subversion, which you can catch in our galleries until Tuesday, the 5th of June.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast. Available to download every month from the Corner House website.
Now it's time for this month's What's On Guide. Carl Theodore Dreyer's great penultimate film, Audette, screens at Corner House on Saturday 13th and Wednesday 16th of May as part of our continuing matinee classics season. Here's podcast contributor Andy Willis with a 60-second review of the film.
Film critic and now director of the Edinburgh Film Festival, Chris Fujiwara, has said that Audette is a great film, one of the greatest ever made. And to say that it's one of the greatest films by its director, Carl Theodore Dreyer, really means it's one of the greatest films of all time. Made in 1955, it focuses on a farming family. And it's a difficult film in some ways. There's not really a plot to speak of, but it's a very poetic film. And it gives you time to meditate on the issues that are in play and the machinations of the family. It's a film that melds form and content perfectly. So every single frame has to be looked at, has to be thought about, has to be considered in some detail. All in all, Audette is a cinematic experience, and there's no better way, of course, than to see a cinematic experience on the big screen.
New King Street eatery Mish has been getting rave reviews for its £6 set menu deals. Corner House digital content producer Sarah Leach tried it last week, and without too much indigestion, she came back to tell us more.
Okay, so Mish is a tiny little place on South King Street. You walk past it, you might miss it. You have to go down some steps. Quite a small little place. It wasn't that busy when we went along, but they've got a really simple menu. I think it's 6 different dishes, so you've got things like Goan fish curry, Mongolian lamb, to things like a Moroccan burger. I think there's one veggie option, so not a great deal for veggies, but still really good. £6 menu, you get your main meal, you get a soft drink, and you get a little ginger cake with custard. So pretty much a bargain. A great spot for lunch. I'd recommend the fish curry, not massive portions, but really nice and tasty. The Moroccan burger thing looked really good as well, pretty hefty. So yeah, definitely one to kind of check out over lunchtime.
As part of the Chorlton Arts Festival, the Chorlton Weekender comes to the Bohemian suburb from the 24th to the 27th of May. Expect the best emerging music talent alongside special guests and a few music legends. For tickets and more information, go to chorltonartsfestival.com. The Library Theatre's new site-specific production, Manchester Lines, is now on sale. Communications manager Joe Ledwidge had a sneak peek at their first week of rehearsals.
So yes, the first week of rehearsals for Manchester Lines has been going really well. It's a new play written by Jackie Kay and features music by Erilyn Wallen. It was written especially for Manchester audiences, and the play has 6 characters that all visit the same lost property office where we get to hear their stories and find out more about their lives. It's been staged in an unconventional space up on the 5th floor of number 1 First Street. It's set to be a real experience not to be missed.
Thank you, Jill. For more information and tickets, go to librarytheatre.com. That's just about it for this month. Join us next time when we'll be previewing LA video artist Stanya Khan's brand new show, It's Cool, I'm Good, coming to all 3 of our galleries from the 23rd of June.
You've been listening to the Corner House podcast. Visit the Corner House website for listings and more.